All right. So good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find Inforum online at informsf.org. I am Jory Desjardins, co-founder of BlogHer. I'm so excited to be here, not just because I get to moderate this fabulous panel, but because I'm a real fangirl, as well as an entrepreneur. So this is like a little dream for me to be able to chat with these three ladies who I have watched over the years. Start with Susan Koger of ModCloth. I was going to wear my ModCloth outfit, and I thought that would be too pandering to actually wear all ModCloth, so I held off. For those of you who are not familiar with ModCloth, you can just see the goods right here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right on. I am wearing all ModCloth head to toe, of course.
Fabulous. Julia Hartz of Eventbrite, again, a company that whose service I have used quite a bit.
Thank you.
I believe BlogHer is a customer, and Allie Pincus from One Kings Lane, another company that, yes, I have worked with, and also that I shop at. By the way, I've never stepped foot in a store for the last 7 years. I do all of my shopping online, which is why I'm really excited to be here. So with that said, we'd love to dig in and talk about being an entrepreneur. So I was just watching Silicon Valley, and because my family said, is this real? Is this realistic? And I said, you know, I've been holding off, and I finally was watching it. And what amazed me is that there are people who it's like manifest destiny. They come out to seek their fortune. And it didn't work that way for me. Like, I didn't come out thinking like, oh, I'm going to start a company that's going to go public, or I'm going to start a company that's going to get bigger than this or that. And I have to ask you, since the three of you have founded companies that have gotten so big, so scaled, did you actually plan on that? And I'll start with Allie.
No, I mean, it started off as a project. One Kings Lane was a project that Susan and I started and were obviously incredibly passionate about, and we just hoped to make it through the first 6 months and then the first year, and that's how it was. So it definitely wasn't like, let's go build a $10 or $50 million business.
I mean, so it was, you just like, wanted to pay the bills.
Yeah, and we just were so incredibly, you know, passionate and dedicated to the idea that this needed to exist.
So was it a problem you were trying to solve, or did you really want to start your own company?
Yeah, no, so it was a personal problem. Both of us were obviously, you know, really keen on solving the problem for ourselves, but also very cognizant of how sort of the space was at that time. And you have to sort of remember that the home category back in 2008 is not what it is today. And in many ways, we are probably about a decade behind fashion. So there was a lot to do in the home category.
How did you know, though? I mean, the flash sale model was still so new. I mean, you founded One Kings Lane in 2009 or 2008? 2008.
So we, in 2008.
Yeah, good timing.
And I think we should also share that Jory's partner, Lisa Stone, introduced my partner and myself.
Oh, wow.
So Susan and I got introduced through Lisa, and we're so grateful, and we're forever grateful to you guys. But flash sale, we
thank
knew that.
You. I can't take credit, but I will. Thanks. Great. So, but to finish on that thought, though, I mean, it was such a new model, and guilt was emerging, and some of these flash sale type businesses. How did you know that that would even take off in that space?
Well, we believed first and foremost that shopping for your home needed to be reinvented, and it's also important to sort of think back about sort of what was happening in the economy and in the world at that point. It was the fall of 2008 when we started. And clearly things were changing. And the opportunity for us was really to work and help our partners, you know, the vendors. And they had excess inventory. So flash sales was the perfect sort of solution for our business.
And you never thought for a second, oh my God, this is 2008. And the bottom is falling out.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
Wait, can I jump in? Yeah. I met you prior to One Kings Lane even becoming an idea. And let me tell you, in raw form, you are so optimistic and so curious that there was no way that 2008 was going to have any sort of issue with you starting One Kings Lane. So I often think back to that first time that we met. That must have been in 2006. And I think that one of the characteristics of an entrepreneur is that you are a little bit crazy in a good way. And so I actually don't feel like that it could have been any year and you would have sought out that idea, I feel like. So
yeah, I mean, we turned every challenge into an opportunity. And so we basically shook hands October 30th, 2008, and we launched the business March 31st, 2009. And we set goals for ourselves and were incredibly focused. And again, just use all the challenges and turn them into opportunities.
Now, Julia, how long has Eventbrite actually been in business?
So we were founded officially in January of 2006. I moved from LA, my sort of cushy job in series development at FX Networks, and moved in with my then fiance Kevin Hartz in late 2005, so December. And I was about to take a job at Current TV because that was applying the skills that I had built previously to the same industry. And I have blocked out the exact moment that this happened, but apparently Kevin came sort of squealing in and said, you could go work on someone else's startup for very little money, or we could start something together and make no money and put all of our money into it. And
how romantic.
And I don't know why that sounded like a good idea, and I'm not sure how I said yes, but I think that there is this eternal optimism in entrepreneurs, and obviously Mark and Eric can attest to this, where you don't see a reality where things don't work. The way Kevin and I work so well together is he is the eternal optimist and the entrepreneur, and I'm sort of more of the operator and the realist, but I think I've become much more of a dreamer over time as you know, your dreams turn into reality. So it was 2006 when we officially launched Eventbrite.
And were you fully cognizant that you were
Absolutely
starting a
not.
Company?
No, I mean, we were taking it month by month, much like you and Susan, where it was not only were we going to start this little project, but we were also getting married in 6 months, and so we had that, you know, and we were doing everything wrong. Like, we were starting a business together. Our third co-founder right. had just moved back to France, and so everything is wrong. We're in this windowless conference room or phone closet over on Utah Street, and, you know, you just don't – I had no idea what this could be, and I think in a way it was probably better. It's almost like – you know, when they put blinders over the horses and you can't really see much, because I think if I had known where we were going or what we could be, I might have froze. It might have been too much for me to take in. So we took it month by month, and very early on we got great advice from now mentors and great friends of ours, Michael and Sochi Birch, who had worked together on several ventures, and we said, how do you still like each other and work together? And they said, we divide and conquer. We never work on the same thing at the same time. And so we took that to heart, but it was very incremental. It was like, okay, if this works out in March, great. We're still going to get married. If it works out in April, awesome. We'll still get married. And then it just kept going.
So, Susan, you were in high school.
I was.
We all were, right?
Overachiever.
So you were into vintage. And, I mean, did you ever have a glimmer of a thought that you might actually translate that interest into a business?
Yeah, so I think, I just graduated from high school. I was much older than what you're implying. So we started in 2002, so my business is actually turning 12 this summer, which is kind of crazy in internet terms.
I have to ask, have you ever had another job other than your company?
Yes, so I worked part-time at a candle store in the mall, and I worked part-time at an Italian restaurant.
I can only imagine the VC meeting when you were first like going over there.
I'm like, all right, I got some great skills. I was actually a student funder at Carnegie Mellon, so I called up alumni during my first 2 years at the school as well.
So you knew how to ask for money. That's cool.
Yeah, that was actually a really great training experience, learning how to do the, like, I'm a student calling from Carnegie Mellon, how are you doing this evening? Like, it's good training to just hear no over and over again and learn how to just, like, So how about $100? That would help us too. Yeah, so don't ever hang up on those people. It's not nice. That's a student.
You never know because yeah, they may start a company.
It's true. It's true.
Yes.
But yeah, for me it was, you know, I've always loved fashion. It's always been something that I've been passionate about. But I wasn't necessarily a designer or an artist, and my parents definitely weren't necessarily encouraging me to pursue a more creative career path. Like, you know, they wanted me to, and I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do, so I decided to apply to Carnegie Mellon and be a business student. And when I was shopping for my winter wardrobes, I grew up in South Florida, and I was moving to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and living in the cold for the first time, I realized that there was just amazing vintage clothing and especially vintage winter wear in the thrift stores around South Florida. And in 2002, the internet was very, very different. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think about how much things have changed. And, you know, when we did move out to the Valley and I talked to people here, you know, they were kind of like, wow, you were just getting into it like right after the bubble burst. And, you know, for me, it was, I really had no inkling of any of that kind of happening. But I just, you know, I was totally bit by the entrepreneurial bug. Like, I was like, wow, I can buy a vintage coat or a vintage t-shirt and someone around in a different part of the country or even in a different part of the world will buy it from me and I'll get to ship it to them and then I'll get to go out and buy more. And that was just like such a cool experience.
But you bootstrapped for a while.
We
for
did,
a long time.
Yeah, for a very long time. So my my co-founder, Eric, who's here, was my boyfriend at the time. We were actually, talk about being crazy. I mean, we were high school sweethearts. We went to college together.
We'll touch
on
risk.
Married. We run this business together. And he had started a web hosting business in high school with two of his friends. And so we got kind of like discounted hosting, and Eric helped me hack a open source shopping cart together. But I basically kind of taught myself Photoshop and web design and like a little bit of coding to make the first version of ModCloth happen. And it was kind of one of those things that I just thought like, okay, like I'll try it, I'll learn something new. I'd actually quit the Italian restaurant job. So I was like, yeah, this summer free, this seems like an interesting thing. And if I get to go shopping more, that would be great. Cause I was so passionate about like getting to, you know, just like if you put me in a room with 1,000 garments, like I will find you the best garment in that room. Like it's just always something that I've loved to
That's
do.
That's your superpower.
It is my superpower. Yeah.
So if you had to translate, so when you walked into, first of all, when did you decide to get VC funding? At what point in the business?
So I ran the business part-time while I was an undergrad at CMU, and it was very, very slow at first, but I think it was actually a great opportunity for me to really learn our customer, and it was a great kind of like training ground. So I got to learn a lot about SEO. I got much better at my like very weak rudimentary Photoshop skills and my marketing skills, and it was really nice that I had the opportunity to run the business without it being, you know, without it having to be my sole livelihood in the beginning, because I had student loans and, you know, of course, the telefunding job that was very lucrative.
Right. There wasn't that pressure to have to make it work.
Yeah.
It just could grow organically.
Yeah. So when I was approaching graduation, like, I realized that we had a lot of traffic. Like, we had a lot of people coming, we just didn't have the right supply with all this one-of-a-kind vintage. So we started selling, I started going out and finding independent designers, and, you know, that was really when I kind of made the decision and knew that it could be something much bigger. But for me, much bigger was just like, can this support me after graduation? That would be great. Because I was looking around and I looked at my classmates and none of them were going on to do jobs that seemed even half as interesting as what I was doing or what I could be doing working on ModCloth full time.
So how did the VC part come into that? And I think, and yeah, I'm bringing this up because I mean, I would just say that usually the VC decision, I don't know if it's a male-female thing, but I find that many of my friends who are female entrepreneurs have often said, like, I'm growing the business, and then we'll determine that. But it's not a given that we're going to go get VC funding. It's when you reach this inflection point. And I'm just curious to know what that inflection point was for you.
Yeah, so for us, you know, I'd kind of made the decision to go into it full-time. I graduated in 2006, and we didn't actually raise our first round until 2008. So we continued to bootstrap. I mean, the business was I was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's actually a great place to start a business because you super talented people there and space is really cheap. You can live very thriftily in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, especially compared to San Francisco or a place like New York. I often think about like, wow, if I'd gone to NYU, I bet my life would have been different. So it wouldn't have been
such a difference from like the traveling, you know, camping out in Palo Alto until you get a place, you know, you just code until you can get your move, right?
Yeah. And we scraped and like we got extra student loans and we lived super thriftily to be able to really gain as much momentum as we could before we went out to raise funding. And, you know, honestly, raising funding for the first time, even though we had this great momentum, like we were on $1 million run rate, $1 million of revenue from bootstrapping is like nothing to sneeze at. But, we were still like super young and based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and a married co-founding team, which was like, I think the VCs like to call it funky. So it was still not, not necessarily the easiest process, but for me, that decision, the point really came to, you know, like we just have so much demand and we just can't keep the supply going in this way. Like we have to get serious capital behind this.
So Allie, you're kind of nodding but I would think for something like One Kings Lane, you need the capital up front. Did you know right away that you were going to go and get VC funding or just see how it goes and then go?
No, I mean, we absolutely bootstrapped the business, you know, for 9 months. And, you know, the momentum was, we were really lucky because we got, we worked really hard though to make sure that we launched with just something that was powerful and something that really was enticing to shoppers. And so, you know, we launched at the end of March and it was a hard debate between Susan and myself because I had been working in the web space since 1996, and the prospect of funding was something that I was super familiar with. Whereas Susan had come from the fashion world. She'd been running, you know, sales organizations for really, really big companies, and she worked with private equity people, but the whole notion and idea about, you know, funding a smaller business was just something that she didn't have, you know, direct experience with. And it was a real debate and conversation. You know, do we take smart money? Do we take friends' money? You know, and we had those long conversations, and I repeat, long conversations. And we closed our first round 9 months after launch,
which is pretty quickly,
I guess. But it's also you hear about a lot of businesses obviously launching today that are pre-funded, right? Mm-hmm. And are pre-revenue. So this was right. post revenue, and we had great traction.
Did you have some traction to speak about at the point that you were fundraising?
Oh, of course. I mean, we were, you know, the annual run rate was like,
can't always assume.
It was at a really strong point. It was also the audience, the pace at which our shoppers were shopping, the loyalty. So all, you know, there were tons of metrics that we were able to share and to prove that, yeah, this business is something that could be relied on in the future and had a future. And so, but I think what you were saying was so true about just, not having that pressure. And when you don't get that funding, you can actually take those chances that you might have been nervous about had you taken someone else's money, because again, we had nothing to lose except, you know, just what we had put in. And it was baby step after baby step. And then at a certain point, you know, we saw, you know, that there was so much demand, and to run the business effectively, we knew that we needed to raise that first round.
And so Julia, Kevin is familiar with, your co-founder is familiar with fundraising. Were you both on the same page from the get-go about fundraising?
We were, in the sense that we didn't fundraise in the beginning. So, you know, Kevin had previously founded a company called Xoom, X-O-O-M, in the international money remittance space, which takes a lot of capital to succeed in because of the regulatory and compliance issues in transferring money. So he had gone out, right out of the gates. And actually, when we first started dating, he would come down to LA and practice his 86 slide deck on international money remittance in my living room in LA. And I was 23 going, oh my God. So I'll never forget that. And he had to constantly be raising money. And so when we started Eventbrite, it was almost an academic decision to just not raise money because been there, done that, kind of exhausted. Let's just see what we can do. So we did bootstrap the company. And we spent less than $250,000 on Eventbrite in the first 2 years. So it's actually possible, and especially today possible, to start a business if you don't have to make an upfront investment in either regulatory compliance or physical goods to actually get to where you want to go at a reasonable rate. And when we went out to raise money, for the first time, when we felt like we actually had a viable product and traction, we got turned down. And that's also a part of the story that I often forget, which is that we went out to everybody and told them about Eventbrite, and it was 2008, and they all said, great, that looks like a cool idea, but we'll see you when the world comes back together. You know, we left the community of VCs with our plans for the next year. And I remember thinking how open Kevin was towards telling people what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And actually, in the end, that's what helped us raise our first round. So in 2009, we came back, almost exactly a year later, we came back to the VC community, and they had all, I mean, the ones that were tracking us had kept our plan, and they saw that we did what we said we would do. And I remember thinking how simple that was, and actually that for all the flack that the VC community gets, there's something inherently good in the fact that a handful of VCs said, wow, you really did what you said you'd do. I'm all ears now. And so for us, when we raised our first round, there was no question it would be with Sequoia Capital, who had been a very strong partner of Kevin's, and we had a personal relationship with Roelof Botha, and it just felt like we were making the right decision from a relationship standpoint, most certainly not from a valuation standpoint, and they know that. But it was a pretty easy decision. So we were on the same page. And then from there, it just felt like this momentum built. So there's, I think one of the advantages of partnering with a VC firm that is reputable is that others want to then invest money because you are validated. Mm-hmm. So we felt we were validated, and we raised two subsequent growth rounds. And then we had a really funny experience with our now largest investor, Lee Fixel from Tiger Global, where it was just in this unsuspecting way that we met him, and we actually thought they used to be the largest shareholder in Live Nation, so we actually thought like, oh, they're kind of like the enemy, and we met Lee and basically fell madly in love with him because he understood our business and he understood where it was going, and he really understood the vision of building this global marketplace, emphasis on global, which is where I think they really help, But they ended up investing and have been huge supporters of ours. And so we've raised $200 million to date, which is crazy because it doesn't feel like that. We have a lot of that still in the bank, I'd like to point out. but we've always raised when we didn't need it. So when we finally went out to the VC community in 2009, we actually were break even. We could have kept going just the way we were going. We had a team of 30. We weren't, hobbling along. We were going pretty well. Every time we've raised a round, it's always been well before we've needed it, which I feel like definitely, it molds the conversation and it changes the tone of the conversation. And so I think that's been to our advantage.
No, I think that's smart. It's funny because in 2009, we were actually getting our C round and we had a similar conversation where we're like, well, we don't think we need it, but we just did it so that we wouldn't have to worry about it. And I know that you want to be very careful about the fundraising and not over-raise, but at the same time, you don't want to have to worry about this, and while you're in a moment of growth, have to worry about paying the bills if something were to go wrong. So, I mean, I totally can appreciate the thinking. And another thing that when you're talking, I was thinking about is when we raised a round, I was talking to my partner, and we had been working out like 23 hours a day, sleeping one, and for us, the funding was like, wow, we can hire people. And I remember we're in the cab after our first round, and she looks at me, and I have two co-founders, but one of them, Lisa, looked at me and said, wow, now we really have to start working hard. Yeah. And I was like,
exactly.
And so I'm curious to know, post-funding, how did life change?
You know, I don't feel like life changed much. I think Kevin and I are glutton for punishment, basically. Like, we would create board decks before we had a board, and we would present them to Kevin's father. I'm not kidding. Every month.
That's really cute.
I mean, out in Orinda by the pool. So here's it hasn't changed much because I think we've found the right partners. And I think it's so important. I'm sure you guys can attest to this. Like, you have to find the right people to invest in your business and to partner with you, just like you find the right people to join your company as employees or you find the right advisors. It makes all the difference in the world. So I don't know. I mean, this is on record. I don't feel like I'm beholden to this group of people because I feel like we're all in it together. And so I didn't, you know, yeah, we had this inflection point in 2010 where we grew from 30, which is a team, to 100, which is a company, because of the capital. But that's the only time I've ever really felt like the capital made any difference or that I had. But I've never felt like I've been beholden to the investors, I guess. And I think that's the difference between finding the right partner and the right investor and perhaps having an unfortunate mismatch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, and it's, I don't know, particularly apt for us since we actually are married to our co-founders, but in a lot of ways as you're choosing your investors, and I think that something that I didn't truly understand at the very beginning is that you're kind of getting married to these people. Like they, you know, as an entrepreneur, like your work is such a big part of your life, and when you bring investors on board, they are part of your life in that way. And I think it's so important that you guys like define success in the same ways. And like you really think about, okay, like is there a potential outcome where I would be really happy and the investors would be really upset, or where the investors would be really happy and I would be really upset? And I think that is, thinking about it as a marriage is really important.
And do you manage the investor relations? Which of you, or who does that at your company?
So Eric is our CEO. I'm our chief creative officer. So Eric takes the brunt of the investor relations and that work. But I mean, when you're going out and you're raising capital for the first time, especially, you know, the founders are
selling in the team.
Yeah, you're selling it together.
Yeah.
And it's, I think that we both played a very active role in doing that. And I think similarly, we had, so we actually were, our first venture capital term sheet came from like a local investor in Pittsburgh, and we were kind of like, oh, I'm not so sure about this. And he actually was like, okay, you have to go see this lawyer. She's the lawyer that I use for all of my deals. She's the best lawyer in the city. And I was kind of like, okay, we're going to go use your lawyer. That sounds like a great idea. And she actually turned out to just be like an incredible advocate. She's still a lawyer today, Marley Myers, with Morgan Lewis in Pittsburgh. And I think in the same way that you were talking about meeting Lee, you know, you just kind of never know. It's like you have to have that elevator pitch and like what you're doing like ready at all times, because you never know who you're going to meet that's going to be able to help you. Marley actually introduced us to Jeff Floor, who's the former founder or the former CEO and founder of StubHub. And he introduced us to Josh Koppelman and First Round Capital. And like that's kind of how we got started, was through this lawyer that we kind of met on a whim. And they like, okay, sure, we'll go meet with your lawyer type thing. It turned out she's been like this incredible advocate for us. So I think even if it's like, you know, you're going to go meet this person who you would never expect to be able to help you, whether they're like invested in your competitors or whatever it is, I think as an entrepreneur, you always have to be willing and open. And I think when you are always ready with that 30-second elevator pitch have it down.
You never felt concerned that you weren't working with the Silicon Valley staff. You know, like as soon as you, did you ever feel like I needed to be I need to be working with someone in Silicon Valley and connected to all, you know, the various professionals that you get connected to once you're talking to, say, a VC in the Valley.
I think for us, being based in Pittsburgh and just kind of trying to, like, being this funky founder team, we were just like, all right, we have this rocket ship, and like we need more fuel, and kind of just like, who's going to give us more fuel? We weren't really thinking about, you know, let's get to the Valley, let's figure out. I mean, that was in the back of our minds, but it was kind of like first things first.
But you guys were, I mean, Josh. Had such incredible experiences.
And like he's invested in One Kings Lane as well, right?
Yeah, and so is Lee. And so I was giggling to myself just thinking about, you know, to your point about marriage, like that was something that we really talked about and also agreed that fundamentally we were getting married to our investors.
Yep.
And I think Susan and I also said something very similar, which was, okay, now the real work begins. Not that we weren't working hard, but, you know, when you take someone else's money, the stakes go up and you feel so much more responsible and just, you want to always just keep on delivering and delivering even better and better. So,
and I think following on to Susan's point about, you never know when you're going to meet that person. One of the things that I couldn't quite figure out in Hollywood was how my career was going to get better by the relationships that I had. And I was exhausted by the fact that no matter how hard you worked, which was a novel idea at that point, like how you would get ahead by having, you know, 10x more relationships. And it was almost like a relationship economy in itself. And I didn't really want to participate in that. That was not something that felt organic to me. Yet here we are, where in these situations where the most unsuspecting person or people will become your greatest advocates. I have one other example, which is when we were in that process of closing our first round of funding, a venture firm said, oftentimes VCs will have an expert in your field come in to vet you. And I think it's a great opportunity to get outside advice and perspective. But you get rung through this like multiple times. And one firm said, we'd like to send in the ex-CEO of Ticketmaster to come talk to you. I went, Kevin, I can't be in the meeting. I can't, like, it will go badly if I'm in this meeting.
Why would you say that?
I just thought that maybe he might be kind of douchey. Like, I didn't know. Thanks. And so Kevin drugged me to the meeting. Kevin's really good at meeting everyone and hearing all of their opinions. I mean, the guy just loves feedback. And so I was sitting there in the meeting, and all of a sudden I realized this guy he's the opposite of douchey. He's super smart. He's an incredibly charismatic operator and leader, and we could actually learn something from him. And after the round was closed and we didn't actually sign with that firm, we just called him out of the blue and said, do you want to join our board? And it was, I think it shocked him as much as it shocked us when he said yes. And Sean Moriarty has been, honestly, that one of the biggest inspirations for us. He's been a close advisor for 2 years. He came up from LA, and for 2 days a week, he'd sit in between Kevin and I in our office and have just open office hours to the entire team, not just us. I mean, really incredible asset for us. I don't think we'd be here if it weren't for him.
Well, and you decided to ask, which is something you wouldn't think to do because you're disrupting what he built. And yet,
we were audacious enough to ask him to just join the board. I mean, it was almost like having a one-night stand and saying, let's get married. You know, I mean, it was like, and it worked out. I mean, that is truly one of the things that I think is so incredible about that. It's not about being particularly calculated in your relationships as much as being open to all the possibilities. And I love when life throws you something that you think is going to be one thing and it turns out to be another.
I want to ask about co-founders because, yes, we know that in two of three cases here, co-founders are also spouses. There's a book that I read about 8 years into my company about co-founders, and apparently, statistically speaking, the least likely successful partnerships are the ones where you're either married to the partner or related to the partner in some way, and you all seem to make it work. So I would like to understand a bit more. You talked a little bit, Julia, about how you created boundary, but I would like to know more about that and how you divvy up that labor and how you work that relationship. And then in your case, Allie, because you have a spouse who is an entrepreneur, did that affect you at all? And do you you have a partner outside, which is good, I would imagine, but do you still borrow from that expertise that Mark has brought? From a,
you go first.
She looks at me like, what expertise? What are you talking about?
So the first question was about how do you sort of divide and conquer with
Yeah,
your
and also about
partner.
How you chose your co-founder, because I mean, yes, your investors are important and you're getting married to your investors, but you're getting married to your co-founders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or co-founder.
Sure. So with Susan, it was incredibly organic, and you know, it's also important and helpful to know that we didn't live in the same city. Okay, I was living in San Francisco and Susan was in Los Angeles. And we met through Lisa. Lisa, a blogger, introduced us via email. And we responded to each other that night, and we got on the phone, I think, the next day. And after that point, we just didn't stop talking, and we didn't stop emailing. And then the date happened. And I flew down to Burbank, and she picked me up in her car. And, it was really funny because we had been talking nonstop, and then here I am in her car, and we're kind of like on a first date. And then that night, her husband asked me a lot of questions. A lot of questions.
Needed his approval, huh?
I had to get approved by Bob. And we just sort of knew. And 2 weeks later, we shook hands. She came up, and we were meeting with my friend Trina, who helped us with our logo. Or we had a first meeting to talk about the logo and the brand. So it happened. And with regards to your question about Mark, you know, Mark's an incredible entrepreneur. And I think the best advice he gave us was, you know, think about this as a project. And that's what we did. Right? So that also safeguarded us and made us feel, you know, we were obviously working incredibly hard, but we needed to also be aware that this whole thing could fail. And how do we prepare for failure, right? And preparing for failure takes many forms. It's being really smart about your contracts. For us, it wasn't hiring employees. It was working with consultants. Mm-hmm. It meant, you know, stretching ourselves in a variety of ways. So, for example, the company that built our website wasn't based here. We couldn't afford to hire engineers in San Francisco or the Valley. We drove to San Luis Obispo, and we found a firm, an amazing firm, who built our website and also managed our customer care and also had a warehouse. Because we had to be really smart, again, about sort of how we set up this business and how we managed every dollar. So,
Julia, talk more about your boundary setting and how you establish yeah. that.
Boundaries. I guess, so for Kevin and I, we've always, first out of necessity, focused on different areas of the business. And so I guess like in hindsight now, I can say that I've always been about people and he's always been about product. And so in the beginning, it was about finding the people to use our service and caring for them. And then I would feed all of that to Kevin, who would design the product. And then Renaud, our third co-founder, would build the site, and we would QA. And it was this like 24/7 dev schedule, because remember, Renaud was in France. And it worked out quite well for the first 2 years. It was just the three of us. And then in 2009, when we raised that capital and we were about to grow from a team to a company, I felt like it was inevitable that we would go through this hyper-growth phase and we would sort of destroy the culture, or we would lose our identity by the end of that, because I saw so many people go through that and I thought it was just inevitable. But I also realized at that time, and I had our first child, that I felt for Eventbrite the same way I felt for my own child. And I know that sounds so weird, and someday they'll be in therapy over it. But there is this unconditional loyalty and this fierce love that you have for something you create. So I decided to put the inevitability and then that unconditional love I had together and kind of at that moment had an epiphany that I could focus just on the people of Eventbrite. Because at that point, I had found Brightlings, which we call them, much more brilliant than myself to run things like marketing, Tamara Mendelson, who I have the great pride of saying I hired, runs our global marketing at Eventbrite. Dana Killian runs our customer service. And I got to kind of say, I want to be the advocate for the people of Eventbrite. And so I really got to kind of carve out my own role. And it's evolved over time, and I really had no idea what I was doing. But I felt like, inherently, if I could come to the table of any major decision of which I had access to and say, here's what I think is right for the people of this company, I felt like I could maybe make a difference in that inevitable trajectory. And it's worked out really well. I mean, it's a journey. I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow, but it's worked out well. And so for Kevin and I, it's about really defining our roles over time. I think it's important to have one CEO. Kevin is our CEO, and we're really lucky to have him. And in many ways, he's my mentor. I get to sit next to him every day. And one of the things that he does for me is he doesn't see a reality where I can't do anything. I mean, he thinks I can do anything, and that's insane, and also incredibly inspiring to me. I think that we've just really kind of carved out these nice roles for ourselves where we very, very seldom overlap, and I can't really remember a time where we've broken our golden rule of divide and conquer. There's been little moments here and there where, and you know, it shows, it puts strain on the relationship, and then we step back and go, oh, we broke the rule, like, you know. So I don't know, I think we both at this point feel incredibly humbled and honored to be operating the company that we founded, because that's not a given. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a privilege, and I think that we wake up every single day feeling lucky to be in that position, and we'll be there until they show us the door.
I want to make sure that we get to some questions.
Hi. You each, all four of you, are speaking so well and generously. Thank you. My question is a bit of a selfish one. I recently launched my own company, and one of my struggles is with identity. And I'd love to hear what you'd have to say about your own experiences with who are you as a person. For me, am I a maker? Am I a business person? Am I a designer? And also the identity of your company. Is it this small thing that I can manage because I know how to do that? Or is it this bigger thing? And you've all taken that bigger thing path. So I'd love to hear some thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I think
this you mentioned something about that when we spoke earlier about having to create, to forge that next step and that culture in the bigger picture.
Yeah, I think this is definitely something that I feel pretty intimately familiar with. And I think that anyone who's created a company, you feel this fierce like love and affection for it. I don't have kids, but I have dogs, and so I can imagine.
Thing. Same
day. So I totally get that, and I joke a lot of times that like my middle name is Modcloth, and I'm kind of like, you know, one day I won't be running Modcloth, and what will that mean for me? And I think if you want to run a lifestyle business and you want to just do it yourself, like you can absolutely do that, and it can be very much like a part of who you are. I think in order to grow it, though, you have to step out and you have to kind of consciously make that decision. And I think to Julia's point of kind of like, who do you want to be in the company, right? Like if you want to be the spokesperson for the company, if you really love doing that, if you love, you know, you're like, man, one day I would love to just do public speaking all the time and be on TV and do this and that, like, then I think that you absolutely can do that. But if that's not what you want, then I think you have to kind of figure out like what your company means to your customers and how you can best shape that. And I think what I'm trying to get to is like, what's the kind of emotional core of what your company does and what your company means.
And what you're bringing to
your
company.
Yeah, and I think
what is your ultimate contribution,
yeah,
right? Maybe it's not about being the face. It might be about the person that's in the back that's encouraging other people to be the face.
Yep, or the person in the back that is encouraging, you know, the employees of the company and that's building the culture. And, you know, like, yeah. I think that as an entrepreneur, you have to be really selfless in a lot of ways, but I would you you get to be selfish about one thing, and that's like building your job to be exactly what you want it to be. And that doesn't mean that you get to do exactly what you want to do all the time, but you get to work towards building that. Mm-hmm. You know, as you give up, in my case, like it was like, okay, I'm not going to photograph the products anymore. You know, I'm not going to ship the boxes anymore. And you like give that stuff up and you shape exactly what you want to do. That's really, it can be very hard to do, but it's really rewarding.
I agree. Question.
Hello, my name is Tim, and I'd love to give the panel's thoughts on the fact that yesterday Google released their numbers on diversity, and 70% of their employees are men, and only 12% of their technical employees are women. With diversity being such a hot topic and conversation within the industry over the last couple years, do you think that other companies following in their stead will advance the conversation, or are there other things that you think that will encourage more women to follow in your footsteps?
I was surprised by the numbers. Did you? I was quite surprised. I think my general philosophy is you can't be it unless you can see it. And so I think having women in leadership positions is incredibly important. I remember going and secretly counting the gender of Eventbrite because I didn't want to freak anyone out, you know. We are really close to 50-50. We're not 50-50 in engineering. We're somewhere like 70-30. Which I think is actually pretty good. I just went through a tour on Southeast universities talking to the technical, the engineering departments, and nobody has 30% females in their engineering department right now, which is scary because we all think that it's getting better. So, I think it's really important to model. And I take role out of that because role model feels like a very big... It feels like almost like a mentor. It feels like a big obligation. I think just modeling, you know, for anyone is important to see something that they can be. And yet building a great company that explores diversity and that celebrates diversity is obviously something we all should be thinking about and doing, not just thinking about.
And do you, Allie, Susan, do you think about it as well in terms of developers? Or is it really, I mean, I could speak for BlogHer. We're... almost, I think 90%, I'm looking over at our head of finance here, 90% women. But tech, thank you. We have one tech person here, thank you, who's female. But we don't have a huge number of tech. And I don't know if we think about it all that much, but when it came to developing the product, it kind of made sense to talk to a female blogger in the space who actually knew how to develop tech for women, right? I mean, what do we think about? And do you think about that, given that your customer is a female?
Yep. Yes, and I'm actually looking around the room. I'm trying to find our women from One Kings Lane. There they are. many of them are developers and engineers, and you know we have worked hard because you know you want to find obviously like great women and great leaders and great talent. But I also think it's important to remember that we live in a really special place. I mean, I, for example, get to meet a lot of female entrepreneurs. Like on a daily basis. And I mean, from what I'm seeing sort of like this greatness around the idea and the notion that you can do it. And I also think that we also live in a community where people are incredibly supportive of each other, like mm-hmm. the female yeah. mm-hmm. group, right? The women group. Yeah. We're really supportive. So I feel really lucky and special to be here.
Yeah. I think one thing that I would add, so you said like, do we think about this because our customers are women? But, I mean, when you really think about, like, all customers are women, you know, for Google, right, like, it's 50-50, right, because it's reflecting the population. But then when you think about consumer brands, like, I think it's women control, like, 70% of their household spending.
It's 83%.
Yeah, so it's really, I mean, yeah, you know better than me, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we learned, like, customer is king. It's like, no, king's actually a gendered word. Customer is queen, if we're going to say a gendered word, right? I mean,
that's
any
so
brand.
That's so treatable.
Right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think we just need to get used to saying that because it's actually, like, it's not just 50-50. It's, like, women are buying not just fashion, but, like, the cars and the technology and, like, everything in the house.
We talk about her.
We talk about her, too.
Yeah, it's all about her. What does she need?
I would also say, I think in a lot of ways, this starts very early. So one thing you mentioned earlier that I was going to comment on, and we just, you know, there's so many wonderful things to talk about, but like you said that Kevin thinks that you can do anything. And I kind of have had a similar experience with Eric where he's just like, you know, he grew up being told that he could do anything and be anything, and he's kind of like shared that with me as well. And I've realized that, I mean, not to discredit my parents or the people that were around me as a child at all, but like I definitely did not grow up hearing that I could do anything. That was not something that I just believed as a truism about myself. And I think that like we really need to tell the girls in our life that they can do anything, and like really just tell it to them over and over until they believe it, because they can. And I mean, it's something that we can do right away.
Why not?
But we have to do it. Yeah.
Thank you. I know we've got about 5 minutes, so I want to make sure we get to a few more questions.
My question's directed for Susan, but it could really be for anybody. I'm born and raised from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so ModCloth is a shiny example of Pittsburgh technology. They actually play a loop at the airport, and ModCloth is one of the intro companies as you're riding.
I still haven't seen it. People keep telling me about
it. It's awesome.
It
will bring a tear to your eye.
Awesome.
So location is such an interesting topic just because there's so many new tech cities that are rising out of the country. So my question is, if you were to launch your company today, would you still launch it in the city that you originally launched it in?
That's a good one.
Yeah, I would absolutely launch a company again in Pittsburgh. And I think that I think that we're starting to see the venture capitalist community be a little more open to traveling outside of the Bay Area, not just going back and forth between Palo Alto and San Francisco proper. I mean, there's incredible people who are doing incredible, especially in a place like Pittsburgh that has great universities, and you know, I think that there's a lot of potential and a lot of talent out there, and I would definitely love to be part of that. That's something that I've thought a lot about as I think about, like, what could I potentially do in 10, 15, 20 years, like, doing something that supports entrepreneurship in other places, because I do think in a lot of ways we live in a bubble here. It's very easy to be very like, oh, yeah, everyone's wearing a Fitbit, everyone's doing this, everyone's on this new app, when it turns out, like, a lot of... Oh gosh, I'm not going to remember this exact stat, but you know, we did a big market poll of like women 18 to 35, and it was only like 65% of them had purchased clothing online in the last year, and I was like, whoa, that really surprised me because I don't go to stores. I mean, I don't go to other stores. but yeah, I mean, I was just like, wow, okay, yeah, there's still a lot of people in the country that aren't shopping online for everything, that aren't doing that sort of thing. So I think that, do you think in a lot of ways that like outsider point of view can be really innovative? You can get some great ideas just because you're not surrounded by the buzz of like, oh, there's already 10 other people doing this. Well, maybe you're going to be the one that does it right, and it's better that you don't know about the 10 other people that are doing it.
Right.
I don't know if you guys have any experience in other cities.
I learned that early on in programming, actually, in television. So at FX, we were programming to the middle of the country, and yet we do live in this bubble on the West Coast and the East Coast, and I'll never forget working on it. I was the least senior executive at FX and the only woman, and they put me on a show called NASCAR Drivers 360. It's a very highbrow documentary project in which we followed NASCAR drivers, and, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, so to go to a race where there were 100,000 fans in the middle of the country, it speaks volumes in terms of how we are the minority and how different it can be. And so I think that was I had a very early on aha moment on that.
So I want to get to everyone's questions, but I think we've got 1 minute left, and it is an informed tradition to ask for the 60-second idea that will change the world. So I hope you're ready, because it better be good. So let's start, Julia, with your 60-second idea.
Mine's relevant. I'm going to take almost all 60 seconds to announce that Allie here is pregnant.
7 months.
7 months. Like, that. We need to, like... Woo. That's not my... I do think I do think the next Pinkest child is going to change the world along with his or her sisters. But no, my idea is really around what if we could reshape the conversation and the framework or the way that we think about having children? And what if instead of the next 18 months, we had a very clear perspective on what the next 5 years would look like? And I think oftentimes as women and even as men, we think that certain decisions need to be made in terms of having children and careers. And oftentimes those decisions are made within a very small window of time without the perspective of the longer story. And so time and time again, I see people who maybe thought about the first 18 months, but not the first what happens after the first 5 years. And I think the game-changing idea would be to reshape the conversation to help people gain perspective on the first 5 years versus that really life-changing moment that, you know, where you don't have to try to get back into something after you've left it. So I guess it's still a work in progress, but Allie, you can let me know how it works.
I think my answer is just, you know, making sure that we are preserving our earth and our world for our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's my answer.
It's a good one.
Yeah, so this is something that I've been thinking a lot about recently, and I realize this, that I think as a creative and as anyone, you know, an aspiring entrepreneur or aspiring artist or, you know, whatever you happen to be doing, it's so important just to get something out into the world. Like, we always kind of try to make something perfect, and, like, it's scary and it can feel very, very vulnerable to just, like, do it and put something out there. But here's the thing, like, if you are actually... if you do something and then you continue to do it and you practice and you get better, like, you're going to look back and you're going to cringe at whatever you were doing at the beginning. So for me, you know, I look back at that early version of ModCloth that I designed when I was 17, and it's embarrassing. Like, it looks really, really dated and just like, ugh. But, you know, that is what getting better is. That's the practice, and that's life. And I think too often I hear people say, like, oh, you know, I would do it, but I'm just not quite sure yet, it's not there yet. And that's totally natural, like, that's totally human, but you have to just go ahead and get it out there. And if you're doing it right, you're going to look back and kind of cringe, and that's actually a wonderful thing. So don't be afraid to look back and cringe, and then cringe. Smile about it and keep going.
Thank you very much. Brilliant. And I just want to make sure that I thank Allison Pinkus, Julia Hartz, Susan Gregg-Koger.
And this session is adjourned.